Lecture 22, Honen, Shinran, and Nichiren.
We've just discussed the origins of Japanese Buddhism and talked about the great figure Prince Shotoku, who introduced Buddhism to Japan, or at least was instrumental in making Buddhism a part of Japanese political program. We also talked about the Nara period, where Buddhism became an established part of Japanese political ideology, and then moved on to talk about the Heian period. This is a pretty speedy trip through Japanese history, truth be told. In the Heian period, there were two major schools, the Shingon school associated with Kukai, and the Tendai school associated with Saisho. Now, in this lecture, you all should buckle your seatbelts, and we're going to take an emotional ride through the period known as the Kamakura period, when the capital shifted from Kyoto to the city of Kamakura. Now, after the gentle sophistication and refinement of life in the Heian period, it was a happy and in many ways a very sophisticated and courtly time, the Kamakura period, which lasted from 1192 to 1333, brought an experience of great turbulence and danger to Japan. Feudal armies once again began to roam the countryside as different clans battled for control back and forth between different parts of the country. And eventually, of course, a single clan managed to defeat its rivals and establish a military government in Kamakura. But the danger was really not past. This was also a time, if you can remember these dates, it's not always easy to pin down the significance or have the significance of dates as long ago as the 11th or 12th or 13th centuries become clear, but around the year 1300 was the time when the Mongols moved across Asia. They dominated all of Asia from the shore of the Black Sea to the Sea of Japan, and they threatened Japan. So that even when the military government had established itself in Kamakura and brought Japan into something like a situation of peace, there still was this immense foreign threat that lurked just across the sea, the Mongols preparing their invasion fleet to invade Japan. The turbulence of this period brought a sense of crisis and a new sense of urgency to Buddhist practice. It was associated in the Japanese mind in this period with an old Buddhist doctrine we haven't talked about at all in the course of these lectures, called the degenerate age of the Dharma. In Japanese, this is known as Mappo. The idea is that the Dharma started out in a golden age, really, during the lifetime of the Buddha, when he preached it to people who were well prepared to receive it and could practice it and achieve nirvana in a lifetime or two, and really embody the teaching that he had presented to them. Interestingly enough, in the early centuries after the death of the Buddha, the Buddhist community in India began to develop an idea, it's related to Hindu ideas actually, that are quite similar, that Buddhism was declining. It was in an inevitable process of disintegration. It would mean it would be more and more difficult as each period and as each century went on for Buddhists to achieve the same kind of perfection and salvation that was accessible to them during the lifetime of the Buddha himself. This hasn't been important for us in a lot of the teachings that we've discussed so far. It doesn't come up in the Lotus Sutra. It's not important philosophically for Nagarjuna or for Tsongkhapa in Tibet. And it didn't appear often in China. But in this period in Japan, in the Kamakura period, people went back to this old idea of the degenerate age, and they saw in those old texts an experience that mirrored their own experience of Buddhist life in Japan during this turbulent and difficult time. And they looked around for new ways to try to practice the Dharma, as they sensed that the old teachings were in many respects dead for them, inaccessible. Modes of practice and modes of perfection that might have been great for people in earlier times, but were no longer really possible for them to practice in such a difficult environment. Now, one of the traditions that they went back to and began to appropriate in a new way was the Pure Land tradition we've spoken of earlier as having significance during the Tang period in China. In the Heian period, devotion to Amitabha, or as he is known in Japan, Amida Buddha, had been just one of the options that were available in the religious synthesis of Tendai Buddhism. So in the Tendai of Saicho, you could express devotion to Amida Buddha as you could practice meditation or chant the words of other Buddhist sutras. As the power of the Heian court declined, though, and as the national crisis deepened, a number of Tendai monks came down off the mountain where they had been studying their tradition and turned to the streets to bring Amida's salvation to the common people. Kuya, who lived from 903 to 972, was known as the Saint of the Streets, and as he danced through the city and the town around Kyoto, chanting the name of Amida and singing simple songs in praise of Amida's paradise. A key part of Kuya's practice was to chant the phrase Namu Amida Butsu, which means homage to Amida, or Amitabha Buddha. This phrase is called in Japanese the Nembutsu, and it's understood as the way to gain access to Amida Buddha's compassion. So if you call on the name of Amida Buddha, Namu Amida Butsu, O homage to Amida Buddha, the understanding is that Amida's compassion will become available to you and will sweep you along to the Pure Land. You can see how this is a kind of simple and concentrated practice that might really be attractive to people in a difficult time. For one thing, it promises salvation beyond this difficult and painful life in this world. Now, it was not until the time of Honen, another important Pure Land figure, who lived from 1133 to 1212, that the Pure Land tradition began to function as a separate sect. Kuya was still a member of the Tendai school and gave the Tendai tradition his primary loyalty. But in the time of Honen, Pure Land became concentrated and it began to split from the Tendai orthodoxy that had dominated religious life in Kyoto. Honen believed quite clearly that it was no longer possible to rely on your own efforts to achieve salvation. That was the problem with his era as he saw it. You simply could not by yourself achieve salvation. And the only hope of salvation lay in complete reliance on the grace of Amida Buddha. Now, the distinctive character of Honen's teaching is very clearly evident in a document that is called his one-page testament, delivered to his disciples 2 days before he died. And I think it's a good thing for us, actually, to hear Honen speak in his own words. "The method of final salvation that I have propounded," he says, "is neither a sort of meditation." We're not talking here about meditation. I'm not asking you to sit down cross-legged and concentrate your mind. That would be too tough. "That kind of meditation that has been practiced by many scholars in China and Japan, nor is it a repetition of the Buddha's name by those who have studied and understood the deep meaning of it." This is not for scholars. I don't want you to go to school and do some course on the exegesis of each syllable in the name of Amida Buddha. "It's nothing but the mere repetition of the name Namu Amida Butsu, without a doubt of his mercy, whereby one may be born into the land of perfect bliss. The mere repetition with firm faith includes all the practical details, such as the threefold preparation of the mind and the four practical rules. If I as an individual had any doctrine more profound than this, I would miss the mercy of the two honorable ones, Amida and Shaka." That's Amitabha Buddha and Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha. "And I would be left out of the vow of Amida Buddha." Those who believe this, though they clearly understand all the teachings Shaka taught throughout his whole life, should behave like simple-minded folk who know not a single letter, or like ignorant monks or nuns whose faith is implicitly simple. Thus, without pedantic airs, no scholars going on here, they should fervently practice the repetition of the name of Amida, and that alone. You can feel the force of these words. You can see how strong they are and also how controversial they are. He's saying to all of these sophisticated and learned people left over from the Heian period, lurking in the monasteries on Mount Hiei that Saicho had founded, doing all of their scholarly practices, that doesn't matter. It doesn't apply to the time we live in. What we need to do is chant the name of Amida Buddha like ignorant people and we'll be lifted up to salvation in Amida's land. And also, he goes beyond that. He says, you don't just do that, but you just do that. Just that alone. Nothing else. So there's an implicit sectarian impulse here. He's splitting off from the Tendai and creating a tradition based simply on this one practice. It's very strong, very focused, but potentially quite divisive. Now, there was a follower of Honen by the name of Shinran, who lived from 1173 to 1262, who adopted Honen's teaching and pushed it to a radical extreme. I think of him as being one of the most eloquent exponents of the Mahayana Dharma in all of Buddhist history. Like his teacher, Honen, Shinran was banished from Kyoto for disturbing the established religious order. And he expressed his faith in Amida in the following words. This is one of the great statements in Japanese Buddhism. If even a good man can be born in the Pure Land, how much more so a wicked man? People generally think, Shinran said, that if even a wicked man can be reborn in the Pure Land, how much more so a good man? This latter view may at first seem reasonable, but it is not in accord with the purpose of the original vow or with faith in the power of another. The reason for this is that he who, relying on his own power, undertakes to perform meritorious deeds has no intention of relying on the power of another and is not the object of the original vow of Amida. You can see the logic flowing here. It's a very strong devotional logic. Should he, however, abandon his reliance on his own power and put his trust in the power of another, he can be reborn in the true land of recompense. This is Shinran. Strong words. His sect, the sect that Shinran developed, is known as Jodo Shinshu, or the Pure Land sect, and it became the most important of the Pure Land sects, and today is the most popular form of Buddhism in contemporary Japan. It's also found in a very eloquent and appealing form on the West Coast, in California, and in Hawaii, in an organization known as the Buddhist Churches of America. Now, there's been a strong movement in recent years to make Shinran's works available in English and to bring the Jodo Shinshu tradition into dialogue with contemporary Christian theologians. You can see why, because what we're talking about here is really devotion to a great deity, if we can use that word, certainly of power that is infinitely greater than ourselves. And the issue is not so much to convince this deity to deign in his power to reach down and to save us, but simply to open ourselves up to the mercy of that great deity. The kind of devotional logic that you would see quite often in the tradition of Christian theology and in the tradition of Christian devotion. Often this dialogue, a dialogue that I've participated in from time to time to help interpret each side to the other. Often this dialogue focuses on the mechanism of faith and particularly on this concept of the original vow of Amida Buddha. In this respect, I think it's quite similar to some of the concerns that are expressed in Protestant Christianity, where the focus of energy and also the focus, you'd have to say, of anxiety in Christianity lies on the intersection of grace and faith. Why these two concepts, the original vow and faith? Faith, I think we can understand. It's important in the Christian world that many of us are familiar with. Why the original vow? What is it about that concept that's really significant? I've actually done some thinking and some writing about this concept because I think it helps unlock for us some of the deep devotional logic of the Mahayana itself, going back not just to the Kamakura period in Japan, but also to the origins of the Mahayana tradition in India. You remember when we talked about the Buddha and the Buddha's nirvana, the basic idea of the Buddha is of a person who achieves a certain state of perfection and awareness and then escapes the cycle of transmigration altogether. And when he achieves nirvana, his life in the world of death and rebirth is simply over. And he leaves various remnants behind that we can relate to. They're relics that we can worship that are express the Buddha's power, and there also is his teaching that we can use ourselves to achieve nirvana as he did. But he as a person is really no longer present for us to relate to. And this old issue, this old image of what a Buddha is, continued in a certain way in the Mahayana. It was transformed, but it continued. And the question rose again in a distinctively Mahayana way, what is left when the Buddha is gone? The Mahayana tradition answered this question by looking back into the career of the Bodhisattva that led up to that Buddhahood. And they looked at the promises and the vows that had been made by that Bodhisattva before the Bodhisattva achieved enlightenment as a Buddha. They began to work with the idea that that Bodhisattva, way back in some distant past, Japanese tradition, they actually think of this as an event that was beyond time. That Bodhisattva made a promise, made a vow, that if certain things happened, if you chanted the name of that Buddha with faith, that eventually you would be born in the Pure Land and would sit in the presence of that Buddha. So the original vow functions devotionally in this tradition like grace in the Christian tradition. It's a kind of power that has been implanted in the universe that operates even when the Bodhisattva who set that power in motion is gone. And it's possible for us to plug into that power simply by abandoning our self-effort, our own self-efforts, and opening ourselves up to it and receiving it as the grace of Amida Buddha. You can see how close this comes to some of the devotional issues that appear in Christianity. Now, you could ask if that is the image of Amida's grace or of Amida's compassion, what kind of response is it meant to elicit from the human devotee? What response should come from us? Obviously, a sense of humility, an abandoning of any sense of pride, the feeling that we ourselves can grasp Amida's salvation in some way by our own efforts. It also is important in this tradition to be convinced that it's for real, you know? You got to have a sense of conviction, because if you don't have a sense of conviction, it really isn't going to work for you. So there's an awful lot said in Shinran's writings and in the writings of his followers about how it's important to trust Amida with your whole heart, as it were, with all of your being in order to respond to the grace of Amida Buddha. But the interesting thing about the concept of faith in this tradition that most sort of intrigues me, coming at it from a Christian point of view, is faith understood as the mind of Amida moving in your heart. The word that's used in the old Indian texts to express the movement of faith toward Amida Buddha is the prasanna citta, the clear or convinced mind, the citta, the mind or the heart. And that mind is the center of your own being, It's the center of your emotion. It also is the center of your cognitive awareness of Amida and Amida's role in the process of salvation. But it also is Amida's mind. Because we're here in the Mahayana, in a tradition that in the end is non-dualistic. It is Amida's mind moving through you. So what you feel in this Pure Land tradition when you get right into its gut, right to its heart, is a sense of self-abandonment that identifies you with the movement of Amida's heart and mind moving through your heart and mind. And when you can accept that, when you can open yourself up to it, then you can really begin to feel the presence of Amida in not just the Pure Land, somewhere out there in the future, but moving in your everyday experience. This, I think you would have to say, you know, if you're familiar with the language of Christian theology and with the process of Christian devotion, it's not unlike that old Christian statement, "It is not I, but Christ in me." You could very well hear Shinran saying, "It is not I." It is not Shinran speaking here. It is the primal vow of Amida Buddha that moves in me and makes this salvation present, not just to me, poor old ignorant simple guy that I am, but also through me to the followers in my tradition. You can see why it's effective, you know, and you can see why it spoke so strongly to that historical moment when people really were discouraged and they looked around and couldn't see any way to grasp Buddhist salvation in its traditional form. This offered a solution, a way out, a sense that you could feel the power of Amida's compassion working in your heart. This is a tradition alive today and present in as part of the religious mix of Buddhism in North America, and one of the most lively and interesting ways to experience this impulse of the Mahayana working itself out in contemporary culture. Now, Shinran and Honen were not the only reformers in the Kamakura period that we want to pay some attention to. There also was another key reformer who was known as Nichiren, who lived from 1222 to 1281 and was one of the few people that you can really call a Buddhist prophet because he denounced corrupt practices and claimed that he, Nichiren, had the only way to salvation. When I preach about Nichiren, I always really wish that I could preach him to you like a Southern Baptist preacher, because he has a little bit of that feel. He's talking about the one way to salvation, the salvation that he identifies with the Lotus Sutra. Like Honen, Nichiren was trained as a monk at the home of the Tendai school in Kyoto. He also developed a new teaching, like Honen, to respond to the difficulties of the times. But unlike Honen, Nichiren returned to the basic teaching of the Tendai school. He felt that the Lotus Sutra was the key to the Buddha's teaching, and he preached that Japan could be saved only by reliance on the Lotus Sutra. This reliance was expressed for him in the phrase Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, or homage to the Lotus Sutra. Like Namu Amida Butsu, homage to Amida Buddha. And again, I think we can hear the force of Nichiren's teaching best in his own words. "The Lord Shakya," he said, "proclaimed to all celestial beings that when in the 500 years after his death, all the truths should be shrouded in darkness, the bodhisattva of superb action should be commissioned to save the most wicked of men who were degrading the truth." Gotta put on our preacher's voice here. "Curing the hopeless lepers by the mysterious medicine of the adoration of the lotus of the perfect truth. Can this proclamation be a falsehood? If this promise be not in vain, how can the rulers of the people of Japan remain in safety, who being plunged in the whirlpool of strife and malice have rebuked, reviled, struck, and banished the messengers of the Buddha and his followers commissioned by Buddha to propagate the lotus of the truth?" When they hear me say this, the people will say that this is a curse. Yet those who propagate the Lotus Sutra are indeed the parents of all men living in Japan. I, Nichiren, am the master and lord of the sovereign, as well as of the Buddhists of other schools. Notwithstanding this, the rulers and the people treat us maliciously. Doesn't quite have the colloquial feel here that you'd like to find in these words. How should the sun and the moon bless them by giving light? Why should the earth not refuse to let them abide upon it? Therefore, also, the Mongols are coming to chastise them. Even if all the soldiers from the five parts of India were called together, and the mountain of the Iron Wheel were fortified, how could they succeed in repelling the invasion? It is decreed, that all the inhabitants of Japan shall suffer from these invaders. Whether this comes to pass or not will prove whether or not Nichiren is the propagator of the Lotus of Truth. You can feel the strength of this preacher, this prophetic voice, denouncing the corrupt practices of his time and saying that unless Japan returns to the true teaching of the Lotus Sutra, it's going to be swept away by the Mongols. Powerful political denunciation. Nichiren did not hesitate to criticize his opponents, and he was not much liked for this. And he included in his opponents not only religious leaders like Honen, but even the emperor himself. In fact, he said about Honen that Honen, because he criticized Nichiren's teaching, was going to go straight to one of those Buddhist hells that we haven't spent an awful lot of time talking about, but lurk down there for people like Honen who denounce the truth. Nichiren was banished and persecuted for his efforts, but the vigor and the intensity of his message won many followers in Japan, and it continues to be a major part of the Buddhist scene in Japan today. Here in America, the Nichiren tradition is present in a movement known as the Soka Gakkai that is particularly strong among African Americans. It's one of the forms of Buddhism, actually, that has made the most vigorous inroads in the African American community. And it also has produced some important and lively new religions in Japan, both before and after the Second World War. Among these movements is a religious community known as the Risho Kosekai, founded by a Reverend Niwano. This movement played a strong role, continues to play a strong role, in international religious organizations like the World Conference on Religion and Peace. So it has reached out beyond Japan and attempted to link itself with other religious organizations. And it organizes its worship and community life in a way that, again, once again, like Honen and Shinran, is reminiscent of Protestant Christianity. Perhaps not accidentally, because Protestant Christianity has served as a model, at least in the 20th century, for the development of many of these Japanese religious movements. I got a first-hand glimpse of the Risho Kosekai this summer when I was visiting in Japan and had a chance to go to some of the Risho Kosekai temples. And I would have to say that I was impressed by what I saw. There was a vigor and a strength and a sense of directness and conviction in their practice that certainly convinces you of the intensity and the strength of their tradition. One of the things that I saw when I visited a Sunday service out in rural Japan was a setting in a large worship area, like the congregational area of a church, where people came together first in small support groups, gathered together in groups of 6 or 8 or 10, and they discussed problems and issues with each other and tried to work out some kind of a Buddhist solution to them. Then the service itself started with a long procession, and in the middle of the service was a testimonial A woman stood up and talked about the difficulties in her family and how devotion to the Lotus Sutra had managed to help her find her way through some of these problems. Then there was some worship of the Lotus Sutra and respects paid to the founders of the tradition. And finally, everyone left the church and gathered upstairs in the parish hall for a parish dinner. It's a wonderful expression of Japanese religious community centered around the Lotus Sutra, the worship of the Lotus Sutra, and of course inspired by the strength of this teaching of Nichiren. Now, Nichiren's tradition has worked its way out, of course, in other ways in Japanese life as well, but it's important to know, I think, that we're talking here not just about a religious remnant of the Kamakura period, but a religious impulse that was set in motion and is alive in Japan today. Now, there's one more movement that appeared in the Kamakura period, the movement of Zen. We'll talk about that in our next lecture.